future.
Today. My name's Mike, and this is a continuation from episode 19 on the history of Warhammer 40,000. I'm joined by Emma and a good friend of ours, Tim, who got us into Warhammer 4, got me certainly into Warhammer 40,000 way back in the very early 90s. This picks up from the fourth edition of Warhammer 40,000 all the way through to present day. If you want to check out the previous episode to cover the first through third editions of Warhammer 40,000, that's episode 19. You can find links to that in the show notes or through iTunes. But thanks very much for listening, and we'll get stuck straight in. Right, so the first three editions of Warhammer 40,000, as you can see, are a blur of dice rolls, friendly banter, rivalry, arguments.
Fist fights.
Yeah,
and some fairly massive changes.
Yes, the game, over those 10-odd years, changed significantly. And at the end of third edition, we had a game that was very far removed from where we'd started back in Rogue
Completely
Trader.
Completely different. And also the change in miniature styles as well. Yep. You see the orcs, they changed completely. So anyone that had a Rogue Trader era or a second or first...
Some of the second-ed stuff,
If you had an orc army after second edition, it was no... Well, you could still use it, I guess, but it...
It looked out of place.
You'd have to do a lot of changes. You know, you can't just have orcs walking around with a plasma cannon on their shoulder.
I think part of it as well is they kind of refined what the Emperor was. They refined a lot of the backstory.
Yep.
It actually started becoming a little bit grimdark in its tone.
Well, originally the Horus Heresy was about...
It was
five paragraphs.
I was going to say it was bugger all in Rogue Trader.
And it captured our imaginations, and look at us now. We've got...
Full
game systems, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, so, I mean...
Full game systems, plus how many novels
and miniatures
and
audiobooks and everything,
yeah.
So they've really fleshed out the lore.
But certainly we saw a lot, like the Space Marines stopped being mercenaries in Rogue Trader like they were and became an organized military organization of warrior monks, and the Imperial Guard became these different worlds of different fighters, and we saw the Eldar get fleshed out from being pirates to being this sort of samurai-esque race that then starts its fall from grace. And
they really pushed the declining technology and the religious significance of it.
And certainly as the years have gone on, they've kind of turned the Imperium, at least, into a very anti-religious... set up in terms of the theology within the system itself, within the stories, which is ironic since it echoes a lot of real life religious zealotry.
Yeah.
One of the things that I did notice, which I swear there is a link, the only thing that seems to have stayed almost identical is the Imperial Eagle.
Yeah, certainly the Aquila's been, and I mean the twin headed eagle.
Yeah.
It comes from the Germans have used it over the years for different
Romans.
Parts of their. Yep.
It's very very heavily Romanesque as well, you know.
Mm. And I think that a lot of those symbolism was drawn on from Rogue Trader, and the stuff that stuck with audiences has stuck.
Mm.
It's sort of a creature that's grown up on its own, really. It's developed its own lore, its own history.
Well, certainly as they've brought in other authors and other creative minds, they've I think those people, whether they've been given briefs to maintain some of that integrity, or whether they've decided to do it out of respect, or whether they've decided to do it because it was cool, or that was what the fans were responding to, who knows what the directive was there. But certainly there's things that have been quietly left by the wayside and not mentioned again.
I think
and when they are bringing them back, though, I mean, we've had a new squat miniature.
Was that
Necromunda?
Really a squat
miniature?
For Necromunda.
Yeah,
because I saw that and I thought it was there. and your usual white dwarf standing, yeah.
No, this is a proper miniature, and that we're getting new Sisters of Battle next year as well.
But they've done a lot of nods to the past.
Well, look at the Harlequin range. Like, we basically got Harlequins in Rogue Trader. We then didn't get anything. We got a little bit of them in second edition in the Codex for the Craftword Order as a spin-off for them. You still needed to play Craftword Order to run them. Then in, I think it was fourth edition, we got a new box set for them, and they were just a unit in the Codex. And it was one unit entry, and that was it. And that's all we had for up until 6th edition when we actually got a new Codex. So they certainly seem to move through the popular ranges and sort of bring things back as they need to. And look, 4th edition, moving on from where we were. 4th edition saw that, like, 3rd edition had some Tau, but 4th edition was really where Tau found their footing within the system.
That's sort of where they were brought in.
We did get them in 3rd a little bit, but it was mainly the battle suits and the fire warriors, and that was like the Kroot.
It's interesting that it talks about Tau being brought in as 40K was getting bigger in American audiences.
Yeah.
And but I actually have no idea why that would be a link.
I actually think a lot of that stems from the whole manga resurgence when Madman Entertainment got involved towards the late 90s and early 2000s, when they were translating things like Akira and Legend of the Overfiend and Macross Plus, some of the classic manga, not the Robotech stuff you see on cartoon shows on Saturday morning, but the actual the mangas from Japan. And a lot of the influences for the Tau battle suits stem from that sort of Gundam Wing, big mecha robot type stylizing.
And I think they were trying to capitalize on that market.
On that link,
which is a good business decision.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And that's the Tau have always had echoes from that sort of stylized Japanese influence of manga and animation. And I think the contradiction there is that the Eldar race has always been seen as a very samurai-esque, that sort of caste-driven hierarchy with the Aspect Warriors and the way of the warrior and the way of the sword and all that sort of stuff.
And certainly the weapons that they use.
Yeah, shuriken and those sorts of single-edged blades.
Yeah.
So there is kind of a crossover there where you've almost got the old and the new in terms of the old Japan and the old styles and traditions versus the new. And it's reflected in the lore as well, where the Tau are very dynamic and they want to grow and they want to meet new cultures and be part of the new world, whereas the Eldar very much symbolize the end of the samurai era of Japan, where they basically went, we don't want black powder, we want to stay the way we are, leave us alone. And I think there's quite a good polar opposite that happens there, where, like, I'm a big sucker for that sort of samurai style history.
Yes, you are.
So that's why the Eldar have always appealed to me.
I think, I don't know, when the Tau came out, I felt a little bit...
It did feel a bit kiddie.
It was too corporate. Trying to cater to a demographic. That didn't. To me, Warhammer has always been 40K has always been the grim dark, and here you got something that just doesn't seem to fit.
It was the good guy faction. It was literally these.
Yeah, it's funny because Tau always looks like Transformers to me,
and
I always think of Transformers as the good guys. But I suppose there's bad guys in Transformers but. Yeah.
It was a deviation from the grim dark. Gothic.
It was certainly an experiment for 3rd edition, and they kind of tidied it up a bit in 4th. And it's less noble and light shining now we're in 8th edition, where one of my favourite stories is the Tau basically meet Dark Eldar for the first time. And it's the Flesh Covens, where they kind of make Frankenstein monsters. And the Dark Eldar go, hi guys, let's work together. Oh, there's bad guys here, we better stop the bad guys. And it's like a Tyranid fleet or something. I think it was Tyranids. And at the end of it, the Tau go, oh, look, we've worked so well together. You guys are a bit creepy, but we really want to, race relations, rah, rah, rah. And they offer to send 77 Tau from each of the different castes as emissaries to the Dark Eldar. And then they just don't hear from the emissaries at all. And then more bad guys turn up and the Dark Eldar go, let's go and fight the bad guys. And then all these mutant Tau are released from the Dark Eldar ships onto the planet. And the Tau are there going, I think we made a mistake. And then they all get turned into monsters at the end of it. And there's been that sort of killing of innocence for the Tau race. To be fair, the Tau have actually followed along with the storyline for 40K, where they were a brand new thing with a very limited miniature range. Then they got a whole bunch more plastics and they got more gear. And as the stories progressed, they as a range and in the stories and in the game have progressed, because they were introduced at a time when 40K was on the rise, and they've seen the highs and the lows, but they appeal to a very specific style of player.
Well, it's good to see them get grimdarked up.
Oh, they're still quite...
They're too damn nice.
Mate, they stole a warp core from an Imperial ship without a Gellerfield.
They
went, let's put this in one of our ships and turn it on and see where we go. And they go through the warp without a Gellerfield to protect them from the warp, and they come out on the other side of the galaxy going, well, that was a really shit idea.
That was a really bad idea.
No. This is the stiff shit rule. Yeah. Like, suck it up, princess.
I think we've PG'd this one.
Yeah. So 4th edition, though, saw a massive surge of plastic kits off of the back of the Lord of the Rings, the movies and the box games that they released around that time through sort of the early 2000s.
And 4th edition came out in 2004, sorry, Tim.
So, yeah, no, that was at the end of... So Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, I think, was 04? Or was it 02? One of the two.
Which is the second one?
That was the Two Towers.
I think Two Towers came out in 2004.
I would have said it was earlier than that, but okay.
No, it came out in 2004. Well, it came out on DVD in 2004 because we were married and living in that unit, and my friend came round and we had to watch the whole damn thing, and I was so bored and wanted to go to bed.
That was Return of the King.
It was terrible, but it was.
That was the extended version.
Oh, my God.
I remember you and I having the conversation of how far... You know, the kits that come in the box.
Absolutely.
Have come. You know, you and I were sitting down there absolutely blown away because we're used to these single pose.
Yeah.
All.
Like a copy paste 10, 20 times.
Marines, just. You know, and you had three different types of Marines.
You had the Sergeant, the Flamer, the Missile Launcher, and the Bolter.
And that
was it.
And the Orcs should have the Axie Guy, all the same Gretchen. And
that was second edition, and then third edition they gave us the Dark Eldar and the Space Marines, and they were the full multi-part kits.
Yeah, and they looked absolutely gorgeous at the time compared to what we're used to, and that's just advanced.
I'm trying to think what the fourth edition box set included. Now it always includes Space Marines. It might have actually been Chaos Space Marines,
Black Legion. That's when they'll come out with a whole.
It was Space Marines and Tyranid miniatures.
Oh, that's right. That was Battle for McCrag. That was Termagaunts, Gene Stealers, I think it was. I think it was Termagaunts and Gene Stealers. And they went back to snap fit miniatures, but they were the best detailed snap fit miniatures we'd ever seen. And we got the Crashed Aquila.
And that's when we first saw the quote unquote new Tyranids, Tyranid Warriors. Because remember the old style?
Oh, with the exposed rib cages and all the were weird looking things.
So they are the ones we were used to, and they did the whole redesign.
Yes, and those Tyranid Warriors are the current models that we still have today.
And the Carnifex got changed.
Well, he was a Screamer Killer prior to that, and then he became a Carnifex in 4th edition.
And that's when we saw the emergence of the Lictor.
Yeah, look, I mean, we got we'd had the Lictor in second edition, but he was a weird little like tentacle faced thing, and we basically got a full plastic range out of them at that time. We got a new Hive Tyrant. The third edition one was kind of reminiscent of the Alien Queen from the Alien movies, whereas the fourth edition one was, there were still metal miniatures, but there was a lot of plastic, a lot of new style.
And Chaos matured a bit.
Yeah,
as well.
We did get some new Chaos stuff as well.
I remember the original Chaos miniatures you bought. You bought a blister pack of three Chaos Marines, and you got a Thousand Suns Marine, Khor Marine, and a Nurgle Marine. So back then, Chaos Marines were Chaos Marines. There was no real
Legion side of stuff. I mean, the third edition and 3.5 in particular, the Codex for Chaos was really well loved, and the 4th edition one was quite bland in terms of rules, and I think that's what you're referring to in that it didn't really matter as much as which legions you were using, because the Codex was kind of what it was.
And that was the first, was that 4th ed or 3rd ed, the Chaos, the first Chaos Codex we saw?
Well, the second ed one gave us Abaddon the Despoiler and Khan the Betrayer and Ahriman and those characters. The third was just a mess of stuff that didn't work. So they released it again as 3.5. And that's where you got some of the cool psychic powers. And it was a really good codex. And then when they redid it for 4th edition, they took a lot of those Legion-specific things out. And it upset a lot of players.
Yeah, I
I built an Emperor's Children army around that time. My Heresy army.
Your converted one that we had that battle.
Yeah, I think that might have been on YouTube. Might even be on YouTube.
Yeah, probably put a link for it in there.
Well, I think it's probably on my personal channel, so I might have to dig it off that and put it onto the OPSEC page.
That was our first game.
And we got a few things wrong. We got a few things wrong, but that's okay. It was good fun at the time. It was Mortarion.
Mortarion and
Fulgrim.
Yeah.
They're both third party kits because there weren't models for them at the time.
No.
But that army was, my Emperor's Children were built for 40K. They were a 40K Chaos Marine army that then we translated and played when they started releasing Heresy rules. And I remember being really
lamenting because you thought, you know, you'd never use this army again because it was no good.
It was terrible for 40K. It was terrible.
Yeah, and it was absolutely horrible. But we got the chance to play the game and play it, play the new rules.
You still kicked my ass, but
really well. I think that was just luck, really.
No, I mean, that particular army was built pre-Horus Heresy rules because it was a Chaos army.
And the work you put into it was finding, things like, Mark VI shoulder pads, and, you'd go around to each, me and all of our friends would all, save our Heresy,
The studded shoulder pads
and studded shoulder pads for you, or you'd get the phone call going, "Hey Tim, have you seen of these old style bolters?" Or
That was probably a good 18 months worth of work to put that army together because I was hand drilling studs into legs and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, and we'd trade bits box pieces. It's like a donor system.
Yeah.
Really, we all helped each other out.
And I still remember finishing that army going, "Wow, this looks awesome." And then they started releasing the resin kits from Forge World. And I've gone, "Are you freaking kidding me?
Yeah.
You bastards."
And the rules change wasn't friendly. The army didn't translate.
No, it didn't. But like I say, it was kind of intended for 40K at the time because there wasn't Horus Heresy rules. Mm. And it was around
A cult. It was a cult following.
Like, yeah.
It was a new thing. I mean,
well, the books, when I started building that army, was around the release of book 5 in the Heresy series, which was Fulgrim. And I'd read books 1-3, and I'd ordered the books 4 and 5 from Maelstrom Games, which tells you how far away this was, because we used to order a lot from Maelstrom Games, because here in Australia, it was a lot cheaper at the time.
Yeah.
The embargoes hadn't been put in place by then. And I ordered books 4 and 5. 5 had just been released, and I got them the same day in the same box. And it was torture for me for the next 3 days while I read Flight of the Eisenstein in my lunch breaks at work and at night, because I couldn't bring myself to read book 5
until you'd read book
about
4.
The Emperor's Children. Yeah. And at the end of book 4, I've gone, "You bastards, there's nothing in here that I needed to know to read book 5.
Well, it's funny you're saying about books, because there wasn't that much out-of-game literature. There wasn't...
Black Library was kind of there, but kind of not. They'd done like the Gotrix and Felix books and the Ragnar Blackmane series by William King, I think it was. Yep. But Dan Abnett had obviously been doing Gaunt's Ghosts.
Yeah, I think Gaunt's Ghosts is the first of that.
Yeah.
And I think that's responsible for a few Imperial Guard players like Dizzy.
No, look, I mean, you're right. The Horus Heresy series has really put Black Library on the map.
Yeah, and I'm just trying to think of what sort of edition that all sort of...
Like I say, this is...
Third or fourth?
Well, fourth edition was book 5, because that was when I did my Emperor's Children army. So, and we're up to book... I think the next book releases 41 series.
I've lost track. I've absolutely lost track.
I'm behind a few now as well.
I need to find a wiki page that tells me what I need to read next.
fourth edition, we saw the height of competition starting to happen then, lots of tournaments happening, lots of players going.
Yeah.
And
a lot of people coming back as well after second edition.
And at this point in time, we've got at least one Games Workshop in Perth. I think we might have even had two.
Yeah.
Morley was the second one.
Morley in Perth. That was quite...
But I couldn't be sure whether Morley had opened by that point. I'm not sure.
That was a pretty... That was a game changer.
Excuse Certainly, once we had Games Workshop here,
Once we had Games Workshop, we could get whatever miniatures we pretty much
when
wanted.
When did Games Workshop open in Perth? Because I know it was Rain Square.
It was definitely there for third edition, because I remember going into the store and emptying it of Eldar. Like, Jason only had so many blister packs of Eldar on the shelves, and I literally walked in and went, "I'm having all of these." And he made me put some of them back because it was buy two, get the third free.
Yeah.
And I've walked in and gone, "Cool, I know. I've got money, disposable income at the time."
Mm-hmm.
and he had like five packs of striking scorpions, and there were packs of three, and you needed 10 for a squad.
Yeah.
So I went, okay, fine, I'll take three and then one blister pack of the Exarch to make the squad a 10. And then one of the staff there was trying to basically make me do one transaction for all of it, so that it was like $200 box sets and a $6 blister pack for free. And I stood there and went, nah, man, that's not happening. And the argument ended with me going, cool, I would like to buy these three things. And they were all the same value. And he went, what are you doing? I've gone, here's my PIN number. Right, now here's my next transaction of three things. And he's looking at me going, how many times are you going to do this? And I've gone, about 30. And in the end they went, okay, fine, we'll work this out with you. And we took the stuff to one side, figured it all out, so it was equitable.
I just found it amazing to be able to just walk into a shop.
Yeah.
Look on the rack, look for the 40K section and pick.
All the codexes are there, everything.
Whatever I want. You know, and that was revolutionary to me. That's something I've never been able to do. I've always been, I've considered
scrounging stuff.
Redheaded stepchild of the rest of the world, and no one really wants to sell us miniatures.
It was a different time, though, and I know now I sound like a granny, but so
you're
I would.
The one with the
I've got a little Nana rug on my lap as well at the moment, but. So we would go down there quite regularly because obviously it was a big part of your life.
Yeah.
And you'd be inside.
It's a big part of your life too, by default.
No, yeah, exactly. That's it. So there'd be a whole host. I mean, so it was in Rain Square. It was a small shop.
It was.
And I will say it stank.
That's because the air conditioning never worked.
The air conditioning never worked and it was full of teenage boys. It was just, it was not nice. Yeah. So you guys would be in there. And then there'd be however many girlfriends outside.
Well, there was the landing outside with the table and chairs.
That's
so,
it. So I'd be out there
because there was the bridal boutique next door, which were always grumpy at us because we made too much noise and teenage boys outside.
So I'd be outside with Ivy and Luke's now wife, Lisa, and you know however many other girlfriends that were there. And
Warhammer Widows,
Yeah, that's it. Well, that was the start of our Warhammer Widows.
Yeah.
We'd sat outside and talked about ice cream.
So, you know, fourth edition saw them revamp the store. I think we might have had Morley around that time as well. And
I don't ever remember going to Morley, so I have no...
We definitely went there because the store birthdays back then, you had to line up to get into the stores and they always did like a handful of limited miniatures if you weren't the first in the queues.
I always liked it because they had the food court there.
Tim thinking with... You know, priorities in mind there.
Mm-hmm.
But fourth edition for me was a blur of, you know, the first fourth edition tournament in Perth was 2004, I think, is that game's release.
2004 is when fourth edition came out, yeah.
So we had the start of that year was the third Rogue Trader event that the club had run because I won it in 02, 03, and 04.
Mm-hmm. So that was the Skulls trophy, wasn't it?
Yes. And then in... So I did Eldar, Dark Angels, and then Grey Knights.
Mm-hmm.
And then halfway through 2004, they went to 4th edition. And the second GT that Games Workshop had put on was 2004, and I won that with my Grey Knights. And ended up on free-to-air TV, like one of the little, you know, the...
Like curtain TV, but curtain TV.
It was that sort of free public access television type thing where they came and did an interview with me at the end of the tournament, took photos of the army and stuff. And that was kind of bizarre at the time. There were 50 of us playing that event. That was a big event at the time.
See, and that's around about the time I...
Well, you'd had... I think you went into your business at that point.
It's around about the time you met your now wife.
No.
Before that.
Yeah.
So, 04, I think you were probably talking landscaping and...
Landscaping and
we were still getting some games in, but nowhere near what we were doing through second and third.
No, real life had a way of jumping in the way of...
Yeah.
That's where it all sort of started off, but... I got social... I never got into the... Much to Mike's lament, I've never managed to really enjoy the whole tournament. See, it's just too many people, and you know, it's pretty.
You're not the social butterfly.
No, I'm not really a people person. And
he says on a public podcast.
Yeah,
well, I mean, it's really
there are only three of us here.
That is true.
I'm just talking to you guys. Tournament scene's never really been my cup of tea.
Yeah,
but It's never stopped Mike and me from having our social get together game. For us, it's like our poker night sort of thing.
I'd like to think as well that even despite me having that competitive streak, I don't think I've ever brought that to the table against you.
No, most certainly not. We have tested armies.
I've always been up front with that and gone, "Hey Tim, this is
can we test this?
This is going to hurt. Can I play this?" And
yeah, look. The same goes to me, though. I've wanted to test out Mortarion. Yeah. And you say, well, I don't even have a Primarch, but hey, put him on the board. I want to see what he does.
I think that's partly to do with our relationship and having known each other for as long as we have and a level of trust in regards to that unspoken contract that we have for the games and what we both expect.
After all these years, can you remember which games you won and which games you lost?
No.
I certainly can't.
No, I couldn't tell you.
But I can remember we played a game, we had a bloody good time, we drank a lot of Fanta.
Yeah. In some cases, it was Mountain Dew, which is just wrong.
Yeah.
Don't choke over there, will you? Yeah. So 2000
and... the reason that I was choking is because I just got a little mental song going through of, you know, the Stephen Lynch D&D.
Oh, yeah.
And so, anyway... That's, if you haven't heard that song,
we'll probably have to put a link for a YouTube clip of that.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. Look, there's a couple of different nerd songs, but we'll move on to 5th edition 40K. So 5th edition was what,
2008.
I think that's when I came back into it a lot harder, and I started...
Well, it was also, we had the heresy rules by that time.
That absolutely captured my imagination. That really... brought it back from me. That's what got me back into the hobby. It's much harder than what I was before. I was feeling a bit fatigued.
Yeah.
And this really brought so much more depth to the game.
Well, it's funny you say that as well, because, I mean, I was in a similar position where I was not competing as much at that time, and we played a lot of Heresy as the game came out, and it wasn't until the release of the Dark Eldar for 5th edition that my brain went, oh, this is, I think it was 2010, I think, was that codex. Yeah,
dropped like a rock, like an ex-girlfriend. That's how I felt. You know, I was still painting my Death Guard, and you'd just gone over
I think it was 2010 for the Dark Eldar release. Like that, it was a complete revamp of the range, brand new models, brand new plastics. And, 5th edition was the edition of Dark Eldar for me, wholly and solely, essentially.
It's interesting, though, because everything that I've looked at says that 5th edition focuses so much on Space Marines. It was the edition time. That was all about Space Marines.
Yeah.
It was a golden time. It was a golden time for the Emperor.
Look, the emo space elf murderer in me just wanted to come out and say hello.
Yeah.
And I won tournaments with them. I played in the ETC in 2012, just prior to the release of 6th edition.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that army. I still play with that army. It's one of my fondest times of 40K itself, because it was an army that I'd finally found that was much like my Harlequins were for Rogue Trader. It ticked a lot of boxes aesthetically for me. The miniatures were amazing. The way they played on the table was awesome. And it grabbed me hook, line, and sinker more than the old 3rd edition models had. The 3rd edition models were okay, but they never made me want to build a massive army.
Well,
this did.
Just backing it up a bit, I'm just thinking about the change in the game. I think it mainly started around about 4th ed with things like Forge World coming out with their campaign. Yeah.
We did start seeing Forge World around then.
Well, Forge World was actually 5th edition, where they did a huge shift from the metal models into the resin models.
Oh, there you go. So it must have been the tail end of 4th we started seeing them, because I do have a resin kit from Forge World, which I'm sure I actually got in 3rd, or maybe it was 4th, I guess. But there was no real rules for it at the time. And I think it was a case of them... I mean, our oldest daughter was born in 2005, and I had my Titan by then.
Yeah.
I had my Revenant. So there were definitely kits pre that, but I don't know how much of the rules in terms of campaign books we really had.
Well, I'm not just so much talking about the miniatures and so on, but I'm talking more about the additions and the lore that are probably more directly tied to Forge World, like the
Babab War and
Badab War, which is great to read at all,
and the Amphilian Project.
All those big. I think that they would release a new campaign every year.
It was
year.
About once a year, yeah.
About once a year. I think they stopped that when they went into the Heresy.
Yeah.
Because they were leading the charge in the Heresy.
Well, up until a few years ago.
Where stuff. And it got picked up because it was so damn successful. It got picked up.
Well, those big black books, as they are known, were like massive amounts of artwork and colour schemes and a huge amount of story that you just didn't get in the novels because they focus on the technical aspects of what the military forces looked like and what they were armed with, how they deployed.
To huge detail.
Rather than it being a story, it was almost a field manual of sorts.
Indeed. And I think it was, around 4th and 5th. I think it matured more in the 5th. But, that was a part of the game that we'd never seen before.
Definitely.
A company designed to build resin miniatures. Coming out with their own chapters, like the Crimson Scorpions, which you mentioned earlier.
The Red Scorpions,
The Red Scorpions, sorry. They were in the
original Rogue Trader books,
So there's a cross-pollination there. I sort of see Forge World as the...
Well, you and I got so bad with those...
more hardcore...
Oh, definitely.
price is no object. For the real rabid 40K fan, Forge World...
The books themselves weren't cheap. Mm. I mean, it was great for me because it meant we always got free shipping because you were on site on and off.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd just pull our resources. We'd both buy a copy of the new book.
Yeah.
And, whatever little bit it needed to tip it over £250, get the free express shipping. And then the day you got back from site was, Mike, where's my book? Mike, where's my book?
Yeah.
And...
But you'd also see resin-only kits back then that are plastic kits now.
Yeah, like the Mark IV Space Marines.
Mark IV Space Marines,
And the cataphract Terminators.
Yep, the super heavy tanks that are now a plastic set.
Yeah.
The Valkyrie.
Yeah, the Valkyrie started. Dizzy's still got a resin one. He's one of our friends who plays. He's still got a resin one that comes out. It gets better treatment than most of his plastic kits because it is so fragile and made of resin.
Yeah, so, and I think we're in the era now. It's translated. It's the era of plastic now.
Yeah, and certainly we saw that happen. Fifth Ed was kind of a tipping point for that, where we did get the
fire
Dark
Elves. Cast, when did Fire Cast
That happen? Was the tail end of Fifth.
Yeah, that was, I don't know, man. I had troubles adjusting with all that.
Well, look,
it's funny, I think everyone had trouble adjusting with that. And, when you talk to the people who, I was going to say the older players, but I don't mean the older players, people who have been playing a longer time, it's all about the metal models, and they love the metal models, and they can't
until
believe
they go
they've
back
got.
And use
exactly,
them.
That's what I was going to say, and they can't believe they've gone to plastic, and then they go back and do metal, and then it's oh my god, how hard is it to clean metal models and to pin metal models? And
I just did this with my Tau Army. I built 24 metal stealth suits, and I'm going, they're three parts. It's fine. Oh my god, this is annoying.
But it's quite funny because I can't remember what game system it is, but I was on a Facebook site for a different game system that have had everything that's metal models and they're just introducing the plastic models. And it's that same thing again of, metal models are better and we should, I can't believe they've introduced plastic models. And as an outsider watching it, I'm going, give it a year. You never want metal again.
Well, look, I love the metal models. I miss them in a way. I miss them right up until the point I chip the paint.
Yeah.
I love metal when I can stick it in a tub of acetone and strip it and repaint it. You can't do that with plastic. You can't do that with resin.
You can't. But you have got green stuff, but the smell of the green stuff is awful.
I don't know. I've never found it as good.
Simple green?
Simple green, sorry. Yeah, simple green, not green stuff.
But the plastics that you get now... The quality and the cost, they're so much cheaper. Traditionally, metal has always cost more.
Well, the metal models, when they did phase them out, which was the tail end of Fifth, was to do with the global price of metal. Mm-hmm. And it became unsustainable from a business point of view. And without getting too much into the technicalities of casting miniatures and the costs associated with them, I've seen people claim that there's 2 cents of plastic in a Primaris Marine character. And that might be true.
Yeah, but
the cost, there's a whole bunch of other costs that have to go into producing that miniature and recovering costs for it. So while the individual plastic models these days, there's a new night kit that's going to be out in the next week or two. It's going to be $280.
Mm-hmm.
But you're going to have one, maybe two of them in an army, and you'll just want to buy the second one because there's two variants of it. And it's a kit that is the biggest plastic walker kit that they've ever made. It's just shy of a Titan. It's huge. And the level of effort and requirements and things to build it just weren't there, going winding it back to 4th and 5th editions. The ability to design this thing in AutoCAD and have it laser cut into a injection plastic process, you couldn't have done it. And that's something that I don't think a lot of people give credit for. Games Workshop, for all of its corporate decision-making through this period from 5th through to sort of 7th edition, also pioneered a lot of the technology that other companies are using today to produce plastic miniatures and make it affordable to produce plastic miniatures. Because back then, the reason that they stuck with resin and metal was because making molds was relatively cheap. You paid the sculptor to make the miniature, mm-hmm. and that was it. And the Games Workshop have to be given some credit for the fact that they've pioneered the techniques to make these really complicated kits. And having a Titan-style miniature that stands 12 inches tall by itself with such precision that a relatively novice hobbyist can put it together is a testament to how far the technology's come. Because do you remember putting together any of like the metal dreadnoughts from second edition?
Yeah.
Or,
that was
the formation of the dread sock, because once it fell over and fell to bits, it might as well have gone in a sock and been used to club someone rather than actually putting it on the table.
One other interesting thing, just while I'm sitting here at your painting table having a look at, is the change in paints over the editions. It seems like every edition they change their paint style. Now, I remember the going back.
Well, there were the old pop tops, which Forge World was still using up until they discontinued their paint range this year.
Yep.
And then we got the screw top ones that were just diabolically bad.
But also the size.
We do seem to get a little bit less paint these days.
You know, that seemed. But that being said, I mean, I've had that many half-used paint pots. In the old days, I never quite used the whole lot.
Clearly not been to one of our terrain days.
Yeah. whereas now they pretty much assume, you know, you're going to use it before it dries out. So, I mean, I don't necessarily think the amount of paint you get is a bad thing. The range of colours has increased. I think each edition increases. You know,
well, I don't know if you've seen recently, they're just adding more and more colours to it as they release armies, where they go, oh, there's this specific tone of green that you need for this army. Yeah. We don't really have one that matches it. So here's a new colour, and here's the new shade for it, and here's the new highlight for it. Yeah. So that if you want to paint it like the box, here you go.
Now, you'll very rarely find a gamer, Warhammer gamer, sorry. So I'm stumbling over my words. That will blend a series of paints to suit their armies. Say, the tragedy you went through trying to get the right shade of
the Emperor's Children with that.
For your Emperor's Children. Yeah. And then you say to me, well, I can't extend this army because I can't remember what blend I used.
Yeah.
Whereas nowadays, you buy the exact blend.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that's changed, not just...
Certainly, just the hobby materials in general, the access to... And the third-party stuff that sprung up around it as well. And, you know, airbrush colours. Like, Games Workshop doesn't promote airbrushing specifically, but they have a range of airbrush paints. Bizarrely, they're still in the standard pots, which makes them really,
very tricky,
really
to
awful
out.
To use with an airbrush. But they do have a range of airbrush paints. And then you've got the other miniatures companies around the world producing fantastic colours that you can use. And if you can't find the right tone in Games Workshop, you can often go to another range and get the right tone that you want. So certainly those sorts of cottage industries around the game have sprung up as well.
Look, if you just look at the stuff that we've got on the table. So we've got regular paints, paintbrushes, we've got airbrush paints, we've got the colour shift paints.
Games Workshop. Pinvice.
Yep.
Yeah.
Games Workshop side cutters.
Clippers.
Look, if you had said to me 10 years ago, I could go down to Games Workshop and buy
all the tools and everything.
A miniature base holder. I think it's only been released. Yeah, I would have absolutely laughed at you and
It's over there somewhere.
Yeah, got out my old champagne cork.
Cork with some blue tack.
Instead of going, well, you know, I'm not paying $50 for, you know, whatever.
They're actually really cheap. They're really good. I know people who bought like a dozen of them so they don't have to swap it between miniatures.
Well, getting older and the old RSI in the hands and stuff like that.
Not that old.
I look at this miniature holder for painting. I think that's actually a really good idea.
It is actually pretty good.
You know, and so all the tools. Hobby supplies, the tools, all that kind of stuff, that's growing up around probably, it's really sort of come around about fourth as well. It's where Games Workshop really sort of branched out into other things, you know.
It's funny because, you know, Michael's probably the least handy person going. And I remember one year Mum said, oh, you know, what are you getting Michael for Christmas or something like that? I said, oh, I'm going to get him a drill. And Mum's looking at me like, why would you get him a drill? I'm like, oh, no, no, no. Not an actual drill. A toy soldier drill. She's like, ah, that makes more sense. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Whereas, I think I got you a drill and a saw.
It was a tool set that they did.
Well, my first pin vise was a dodgy old Dick Smith's. Remember Dick Smith's?
Yeah.
You'd have to go and source your tools from elsewhere. So you'd go to Jackson's Art Supplies in Perth to buy your paintbrushes.
Look.
After you've done your run to Valhalla's and all that kind of stuff.
Jackson's Micron Pen.
Yeah. You'd go to Dick Smith's or Tandy's and get yourself a pin vise and 1mm drill bits.
Now you can get those from Bunnings now.
Yeah.
Which is one of the local hardware stores here in Australia.
And now you go straight to Games Workshop, you get your pin vise, everything's there. Scalpel blades,
and look,
you get your paintbrushes.
You do pay for your convenience by buying it through Games Workshop. There is an attached cost to have the branded convenience.
Indeed. And I think over time you get used to... Yeah, if you've got the time, you tend to run around and find bits and pieces.
I think it also comes down to preferences. And like, there's certain tools that I'm quite happy to pay for from Games Workshop because they meet the expectations I have for the cost. Like, there's a pair of brown clippers here that have just given up the ghost in terms of the spring mechanism all knackered.
Oh, the Citadel ones.
Yeah, and I must have had those for... Oh, I reckon I had those in 5th edition.
Well, I find the Citadel side cutters and the Citadel scalpel, I'll quite happily pay a little extra for them because I find them so comfortable to use. Their pin vise never really worked well.
Oh, see, I've had two or three different sizes of them. Yeah. And,
I find they just don't, like the end twists off when you try and turn it. The build isn't as what I'm used to with other pin vises. So I tend to prefer the other pin vices, but most of the other stuff.
I've got two or three different companies worth of like different tools and things here, and
yeah, look, I'm seeing Citadel green stuff rollers here, and
there's Army Painter paintbrushes there.
Some brand,
that's Army Painter.
Yeah, nice, awesome. There, you know, but the cottage industry, like you said, the cottage industry around Warhammer is growing up. Like, you know, I'd never be able to find a custom built Inchy Fing with angles and side rolling on it, you know? Inchy Fing, that's what we call...
That was what we used to call tape measures.
Yeah, or you know, the third ed.
The wacky bats.
The wacky bat.
Yeah.
We always called it the Inchy Fing, and I don't know why, but...
Well, it's because they were never actually 18 inches. The red sticks that you used to get in the starter sets were meant to be 18 inches long, and they were 17 and a half.
No, that's the Watergate scandal of the Warhammer world.
Third edition it was, yeah. Thing.
Yeah.
But yeah,
that's another big change.
Exactly.
Warhammer tape measures.
So 5th edition ran through to 2012. Mm-hmm. And I remember that very clearly because we were playing at the ETC in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And the weekend of ETC, they released 6th edition.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And I finished day one and I turned around to look at the table behind me and there's these two guys playing with four armies. And I was looking at it going, what the friggin' hell is going on there? And they've gone... There's allies in 6th edition again.
Yeah, so it was the introduction of the allegiances. Mm.
And all of a sudden, like, there's Eldar and Dark Eldar on one side and Chaos Demons and Chaos Space Marines on the other, and I'm looking at it going, I haven't seen this since 2nd ed.
Yeah. Yeah, I sort of thought the end was nigh. It was just like chaos out there.
Well, the weird thing about 2nd ed was it's probably the shortest edition we ever had, and it was one of the least well-received from a fan's point of view. It was one that...
It was 5 years for 2nd ed.
For 6th ed.
You said, didn't you just say 2nd ed?
No, 6th ed.
All right.
I think maybe because the lore in the game, the fluff in the game wasn't as deep and didn't lend itself well to mixing different armies, you know.
I think 6th ed, like, I think they tried to do too much in one go because we got allies, we got flyers.
Psychic power card systems.
Yeah, we changed psychic power systems again. We changed vehicle rules again. You know, it wasn't the same level of change from 2nd to 3rd. But the change from 5th to 6th was considerable, and it was not all positive.
Changes with the way that the damage was resolved for vehicles.
Yeah,
and
it felt like there was a lot of unnecessary stuff there where they could have tweaked 5th. And there were a couple of things I remember thinking at the time. They included hull points for the first time on vehicles in 6th, And
Hound and Minute, weren't they in second as well?
Yeah, oh, what I mean is once they changed from second to third and we'd had that same sort of system for third, fourth and fifth, everyone wanted hull points to be introduced, but they'd gone another step and thrown hull points in, but then changed the way you did damage to vehicles and changed the damage charts again and added flyers, and it felt like there were a lot of changes there that they didn't need to necessarily make.
It seemed like it was almost too much to keep track of.
It was. It was a big addition shift. But because it was a lot of familiar parts to it, unlike second to third, where the game was essentially a new game, this was familiar enough for you to make mistakes, and contrary enough, like your books kind of worked and kind of didn't work. Some of the rules were a bit weird, that they interacted funny. And coming off the back of the highs of 5th edition in particular, where we had all these wonderful, flavorful codexes, a whole bunch of new plastic miniatures, and we just had the Heresy series, like, coming up to Steam, and you know, there was a lot of really positive energy around the way the game was going. It felt like a very corporate shift.
I think what I hear from a lot of the players who are starting to come back into 40K now is, you know, because obviously when players come into our tournaments, they'll you know, say hi, do you play, that kind of thing, and often they say, oh, I stopped playing in 5th edition, but I'm coming back for 8th. So it seems to have been, for a lot of players, it seems to have been a time where they just went, oh, you know what, I'm not doing 6th.
Yeah. And look, I mean, 6th was a funny season. You know, I mean, we had, like, again, a whole bunch of new plastic miniatures and replacements Codex and updates. Codex creep was a big thing then. And Alliance has also rubbed a lot of people up the wrong way because we'd been so used to playing with mono factions. You were able to cherry pick and make the best armies and fill in gaps that are naturally built into armies to provide a challenge.
Yeah. Specialize.
Yeah.
You know?
So 6th was certainly an edition where it lasted the shortest amount of time. From memory, it was only about 3 years.
It's two. 2012 to 2014.
So when was that horrible, horrible Blood Angel Necron fist bump?
That was. So, this is literally what we're talking about in 6th.
Yeah, see, that was a debacle.
Yeah,
that was
an absolute and look, debacle. We also had the silliness of the Grey Knights murdering Sisters of Battle to anoint their armor. There was a lot of fluff choices that felt very... I'll tell you about that one off air. It's terrible.
Yeah, jeez.
We had Drago carving his name in Mortarion's heart. And
Mr. Warp Dust Sniffer.
It was a demon prince. It's fine.
No, still.
But basically, they took a lot of... It almost became too comical in some ways. It was really... A lot of the Grimdark was wound up, but then it was turned into a Saturday morning villains cartoon. Yeah. And I think it's...
Skeletor and He-Man.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of... It lost its way a little bit for there, which is, I assume, why it was such a short edition. Because then you fast forward to 7th edition, and we're still we're at the height of.
Necrons became a bit more of a force to be reckoned.
Yeah, Necrons were really good in 7th edition.
They expanded on it rather than just, you know, the single Necron warrior. There was more flyers, the Pyramid of Doom.
Well, they wound
flying croissants.
Yeah, well, the croissants were 6th edition when they first, or 5th edition as a transport, and then they became proper flyers in 6th.
Do you maybe want to explain what croissants are?
The Night Scythe and Doom Scythe flyers for the Necrons. They literally look like a croissant.
I know what they are. I just thought for people who perhaps don't, it might be useful to explain that we didn't actually put croissants on a table.
There were people who did. Put them on flying stands. No, we didn't.
Yeah, but I mean, that's not to detract any respect to Necron players out there.
Well,
takes a lot of skill to run that army.
But the thing with 7th edition was they did wind back the allies. They took away the silliness of Tau allied with Space Marines and some of the Alliance stuff that people were up in arms about.
They'd put in some fairly big changes in 7th, though.
Yeah, 7th was a significant series of updates.
Yeah, so things like, you know, they had dedicated psychic phase, introduction for the tactical objectives, Battleforge versus Unbound, and Lords of War.
And also the most important one is formations.
Yes.
Formations was a big thing for 7th, and it started really well. And then it got a bit out of hand as the edition wound on, because we started getting the silliness of the Skyhammer Assault for Space Marines, where it was double Assault Marines, minimum choices because you had to take them, and then two maxed out Devastator Squads toting all the heavy weapons that dropped down turn one and nuked you off the table with a bunch of rerolls. And the army building at that time really did focus on building these specific formations to get the maximum freebies. The Space Marine Battle Company is a great example of that, where if you took six tactical squads, two assault squads, and two Devastator squads, you got their vehicles for free. So your 1850 point army was more like 2500 points by the time you got all your freebies. And there was a lot of that that went through those formations, which, again, if you didn't play the right armies, you didn't get all the cool stuff. So you had Space Marine battle companies being a really big deal, particularly through the late part of 7th edition.
Do you think maybe the formations were more of a marketing?
Absolutely. They were doing boxes where, like the Skyhammer, Skyhammer was quite literally one of the few times Games Workshop have actually done a pay to win. Because the only way you got the data sheet to run a Skyhammer was to buy the Skyhammer from the online store. Mm. And then when you ordered the bundle, that's when they sent you the data sheet. Yeah. And they don't do that very often, but that's one of the few times they have done it. And that was almost a...
Happened with the captains as well.
A lot of the limited edition captains have got that sort of stuff in them as well, but this was something that was publicly available, and it was about $300 or something to buy, and it was very...
A bit different from the captains.
And I think that, I mean, I played LVO at the very tail end of 7th edition, which was 2017.
Yes.
And we knew 8th edition was coming.
Yeah.
And we knew that particular LVO was going to be the last one for 7th. And it was a funny game because the top tables were these battle companies and all these freebie vehicles and stuff. And it was around that time that the corporate governance side of the business was changing as well.
Yeah.
But because Games Workshop, sorry to interrupt you.
That's
there,
right. Mike,
but Games Workshop always, pretty much always, once they started turning corporate, have developed a reputation for testing their customers.
Look, I think...
And sometimes they mess it up really badly. And
Sixth edition's a testament to that.
They receive the nerd rage and... you know, they pull back, they try and readdress, and then they try it again. It's just the hobby. It's how they always roll.
Well, the funny thing is, I think that when they went public way back in, it must have been 3rd edition or somewhere around 3rd edition, like any business, they have to keep shareholders appraised at that point, and there is a level of corporate responsibility, but...
And a business needs to make money.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a business.
The difference is, though, that when with
a business needs to make money is, like... I hear a lot about how expensive Games Workshop is and about it being this whole corporate kind of giant and the negativity that goes with that. But the reality is if they're not making enough money, then they can't employ the people in order to create the stories that go with it
and the miniatures.
In order to create the miniatures and in order to do all the testing that they need to do and in order to change the sculpt, you know, so... That stuff comes with money. And if you look at where they were in 1987 compared to where it is now, that doesn't happen if they're not generating income.
Yeah, but I think we saw a period of time there, particularly through 6th and 7th, where the level of interaction with their client base was essentially zero. They closed all their social media accounts. They stopped updating customers. They
and
would
the
kill
person
any
who was running it was not a gamer.
No, and they kill any leaks that came out.
Yeah,
and then when the CEO changed. We saw a significant shift in the way the company interacted with its clients because all of a sudden a leak had been released. And I don't know if you remember, Tim, when they released the Demon Primarch miniature for Magnus and everyone went, oh! And it's this grainy picture that must have been taken on a phone from 1993.
It was taken on a very expensive camera and put through a filter to look like it was.
Well, at the time, we had to assume that it was someone who'd gone, oh, look at this.
Yeah, that's it.
And the next day, within 12 hours, Games Workshop put a video out there going, hey, like, here's the real miniature.
Very clever, though. I think whoever's running, I haven't kept up with who's running the show these days, but this person seems to be really quite switched on. The old saying...
Kevin Rowntree, I think, is the CEO.
You know,
I don't know.
I think it's Kevin Rowntree.
What is it? Any press is good press? Or
good publicity,
Yeah, any publicity is good press. And if someone leaks one of your miniatures out, you don't squash it. You use it.
Yeah.
You use that, you know... You use the hysteria.
And that's what they're doing these days. Like, there was a leak of the new Imperial Knights that are due out in a couple of weeks' time.
Mm.
The next day, on the community site, here are the full high-res images, 360 spin-arounds. Yeah. Here's the weapon previews. This is what the guns do. This is that. And it was like all the sites through 5th, 6th, and 7th that lived off the sneaky photos and rumour mills and clicks from people going to the site to see these leak have basically just fallen by the wayside because Games Workshop see a leak and go, here you go, how about a 1080p high resolution image instead?
That's similar to what they've done. I think they started doing it back in 5th Ed as well, is a lot of the third party companies,
the Chapter House,
all that, they tried to suppress it with legal means. They didn't try and compete, they tried to suppress it with legal means. Then they changed their tack and went, you know what, let's bring out Heresy era stuff. Let's bring out our own knights, because there's this one guy trying to make his own knight.
Yeah.
These people want this, so obviously we can out-compete this guy on a business scale. Let's do that instead of waste our time with legal funds. And I think that tack, the past 4 or 5 years, they've really turned themselves around from a big, evil...
Faceless entity
to whoever, doing it right.
So yeah, it's Kevin Rowntree, and he became CEO in 2015.
Yeah, so just towards the tail end of 7th edition. Yeah,
well, actually, 2015 is kind of halfway just through.
Well, Kevin, if you ever hear this, I'll let you buy me.
Thumbs up to you.
Yeah.
Thumbs up, mate. I'm not a fanboy, quite the opposite, but I'll let you buy me beers if you ever get the chance.
Well, look, I mean, the changes he made, not just for 40K, but for the company at large, have generally been a very positive shift. It's seen good results for the shareholders, obviously a positive thing.
It's the first time we've seen an advancement in the storyline.
Yeah, look, and that's been a little bit of a...
controversial.
A little bit controversial for some players. I really like what it means.
I love it. I absolutely love it.
I think there's parts of it they could have done differently, but ultimately, you've had fans begging for this for years, decades, and then they do it.
Talked about a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of our conversations off air previously, we've set out the front yard, much to Emma's disgust. And
it is not to my disgust. Just in case anybody comes to our house, I'm just going to put this out there. Michael, the amount that he talks on this is nothing compared to what he does without a microphone in front of him. So people come to our house to drop something off, and 4.5 hours later, they're still standing at our front door.
Yeah.
So I just give you permission to leave.
And we've had multiple conversations on what direction the storyline and fluff and all that sort of thing, and Vulcan conspiracy theories and all that sort of stuff, and it's good to see them take note, mature the game a bit and move it on.
And look, I mean, the next 12 to 18 months of 40K, we're going to see Warhammer Adventures come out, which has been very polarizing for the community, aimed at bringing a younger fan base in.
I'm kind of mixed with that.
I'm still hoping that it's handled the right way, and I'm still hoping that it's going to be a really positive experience for the younger generation, because you've got to think, when we were that age, Rogue Trader didn't take itself seriously.
I'm
kind of hoping we get that sort of experience out of this. I'm not hoping for them to take all the Grimdark out and have the kids playing with Necron Warriors. I'm hoping that there's a reflection of the proper Grimdark with enough humor to keep it a little bit light.
Yeah. Or it just doesn't go into the depth that...
Yeah, the violence and the full-on bloodshed. Yeah.
It can share the overall themes with the same story that you know and love. It just doesn't need to go into the detail of that gore and...
Yeah, the hyper-violence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a bit hard to describe, a Khorne Berserker not being hyper-violent, Like, it just doesn't quite make sense to
Look,
me.
Either way, I think it'll be an interesting take for them to see how they can engage a new younger audience.
Yeah, instead of treating a complete tabling as a life-changing experience and character-building experience, and seeing the youngster with complete and utter shock in their eyes, it's probably given them a gentle, inclusive
introduction. I think the side, like the gaming side of things, I think that's the kind of the disconnect that people are having with Warhammer Adventures is... The game is still going to be the game. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to see a kiddified version of the game. I think that the literature that they're producing certainly isn't aimed at you or I. Mm. It's going to be aimed at gently exposing them to to kind of lead them down the road to read Gaunt's Ghosts and to read some of those things as they get that little bit older.
Yeah. I mean, we have had that genre, I think we call it bolter porn.
Yeah.
Where it's just,
the Space Marine guns down the bad guys and he's awesome and he's dodges awesome, bullets and...
Yeah, and... Yeah, we've seen that genre, and I've always treated that as like kiddie version Warhammer, and
it's literally something that you read on the plane to pass the time.
Exactly. So I guess this is no different from that. It's just bolt porn with a little bit less
porn.
Porn.
As a parent, I can only hope.
I'll probably call it Balti Street.
Jesus Christ. And look, that brings us all the way to 8th edition. And 8th edition...
Can I just share something that I thought was really interesting when I was looking at the different editions? So everything that I was looking at says the new edition was announced in such and such with, you know, on such and such a date in White Dwarf issue this.
Yeah.
And, you know, with pre-release being here and actually coming out here, except for 8th edition, which says 8th edition was announced on Warhammer Community.
Really?
So it went from White Dwarf, White Dwarf, White Dwarf, White Dwarf, White Dwarf, Warhammer Community.
Oh, there you
and
go.
And it's just like, wow, that is a, it's just that big shift.
Yeah, that was, but that was them turning all their social contracts back on.
Yeah.
Social contacts back on.
That's another, yeah, it's another step, I think. I really think, even though they sort of brought White Dwarf back a bit more and tried to make it more than just a book with lots of ads about miniatures, they tried to put a lot more content into it and that sort of thing. I think, I don't know, I think it's time's marked, and I think they're going to probably not support it as much as what they have done in the past.
Certainly the dedicated studio they used to have on it seems to have shrunk a little bit.
Yeah. For me, I think it's just that reflection of the fact that we now live in a time of instant gratification.
Yeah.
So in 1987, in 1998, in 2008... people were waiting a month for the magazine to come out, and you were going on the different, you know,
forums and whatnot. Yeah,
you know, in the more recent years, going on the different forums and seeing those releases and those leaks. Whereas now, it's instant. We're doing this. We're going to tell you about it.
And it's almost daily.
Yeah. Sometimes it's three or four times a day they're releasing things. So,
I mean, how many times do you read a battle report? Or do you even get a battle report online?
Yeah, you still do.
How many times do you read that? Because I remember the White Dwarf magazine would come out.
The battle report was half the magazine. It was like, we got to read that, but we saved that.
And I'll read it over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, and I think information's a lot more disposable. And I think the information on the hobby's a lot more accessible and disposable than what it used to be as well.
Well, the independent content creators, us included, give us different takes on the same thing. And offer different insights and suggestions for how you can use different tools and how different armies can be used. And
but even if you look at the way, I know that I'm going off on a total tangent here, but
no,
if
I've
you
been
look
doing
at
it all night, so.
What's another one? But if you look at the way that articles have changed over time, so I was reading something about how to create engaging content. And it basically says 300 words or less, everything needs to be bullet points. And that is, if you've read anything that I've written, it is not how I write at all. So instead of 300 words or less, it's often 3,000 minimum. There's no bullet points. I try and chuck a picture in, but really it's just, it's a hell of a lot of words. And, you know, everything I'm reading says nobody wants to read that anymore. Well, then that's fine, but that's how I write. So,
but even that... you know, again, like you say, it's the content has to play a part there.
Yeah, but it's just the whole everything needs to be short, it needs to be sharp, and it needs to be done. And everything's clickbait now. You know, so you go on it and you read your 50 words and it's over. And I'm moving on to the next thing, as opposed to going and reading the White Dwarfs, where you'd read a 12-page battle report and you'd read it
12 amateur.
And you'd read it 15 times. And, you know, that kind of thing. Nobody does that anymore.
No. It's certainly an interesting thing. It's endemic of the changes we've seen socially and with technology.
Yeah, definitely.
I think the people's attitudes are changing. The demographic, the attitudes of the demographic are changing.
Well, the average gamer
12 years old or
is not 12 anymore. The average gamer is 25.
18 to 39. Yeah. I think the demographic is.
Yeah. So, and look, coming back to 8th edition to kind of round out this.
Yeah.
Tim, you haven't played it yet?
No. I'll get there eventually. It's
8th edition was something that when I picked up the book, there was a lot of very fond stuff in there for me because there's a lot of stuff that's very reminiscent of 2nd edition. So you've got the movement rates returned. The combat's far more brutal, much like it was in 2nd edition. The vehicles are a lot more easy to manage. There's a level of suspension of disbelief you have to incorporate a little bit in terms of the way line of sight works. It feels more fun.
Yeah, so it's supposed to be a lot easier for players to join and to start playing with 8th edition.
I don't know why necessarily. I think the core rules That
so I hate the core rules.
Yeah, you,
so that's one of the things that they introduced with 8th edition is the 14-page simplified core rule set, which is awesome if you know what the core rules are. But if you're relying on those 14 pages of core rules, it's too hard.
It's bloody
confusing. You need to read it backwards in order, because everything's read this and this relies on this, and then you read that, but that relies on that. And then by the time you've got to that, you've got to go back and read the first thing so that you can actually understand how it all works.
I think you just compromise on, you know, take what you need and take the steps, you know. I can't remember what edition Warhammer had, but they had the basic core rule set. I think it was 5th. I think 5th had a basic core set.
A lot of them had those sort of starter pamphlets in them.
The advanced rules.
Yeah,
you can play like this, but if you want this game to work properly, you're going to have to read the advanced rules. I wonder if it's sort of a run back to that, which I think it was great trying to explain it to, you know, my little cousin when I'm trying to convince him to play.
I think a lot of the there's a lot of players who complain about the current Codex formatting. It's actually very reminiscent of second edition again, and it certainly feels like someone's hidden a point in nostalgia and gone, you know what? There's actually some good ideas here. Let's keep a lot of the complexity out.
Yeah.
Let's adapt the 7th edition rules. Let's tweak it a little bit, and then let's incorporate some of the cool stuff from some of the older editions. And that's certainly what it feels like now. The data sheet side of things, where, do you remember in the 2nd Ed Codexes, you used to have like a single panel and it gave you all their options, it gave you everything in one spot.
Yeah.
And then you had to go and look for the war gear cards and the points values on those war gear cards in another spot. Well, this is essentially what we've got now. I don't necessarily think the points values being the way they're separated in the current codexes is great, but it does still feel, to me at least, a lot like 2nd edition. Mm. And it's got traces of 3rd and 5th in it that I enjoyed. It's got enough of 7th to feel familiar, but not aggressively different. And it's hitting a lot of boxes for me. The only thing I don't like is the cover system.
Look, I think the biggest
system in 2nd was a bit crap as well.
I think the biggest mistake is to expect each edition to be a vast improvement on the last one. It's a game that's in transition. Every single edition they do, they try something new and different, and it may work or it may not work. I mean, you're only going to be stuck with it 4 or 5 years anyway. So hopefully they'll come up with something. But
well, this is meant to be the first living rule set where we won't necessarily get a new edition.
We're getting got with the new FAQs that came.
We're getting a much more interactive company that's providing this stuff, and I think longer term it's going to go full digital.
Well, as long as I don't make it a subscribe to get the latest, you know, a monthly subscription.
You know what? I would be fine with that.
Yeah.
If they turn around and said to me it was going to cost me $10 a month, $20 a month, but my app is going to instantly update with the latest books and all the latest bits and pieces,
I probably would.
$50 a month, it'd still be cheaper than buying every codex.
As ashamed as I am of
Squint on Emma's face is maybe not $50.
Yeah, maybe not $50.
As ashamed as I am to say it, I probably would too.
Honestly, when you actually factor it all in, if it's a decent army building suite in there as well, and you get all the live updates, the rule books are updated as they release the FAQs, you get access to the codexes. If they turn around and say to you, okay, Tim, it's going to cost you $5 for the app, and that'll give you the basic army building app with nothing in it, and then you pay $5 per army you want to add to that, and it updates all the rules for anything you buy for an army that goes in that app, and it costs you $5 a month.
For
a player who plays regularly, it's nothing.
Look, if I can buy a $170 Land Raider, surely I can afford, you know,
what is essentially whatever, $50 a year.
Which is essentially, but, you know, I think that's this decade's trend is more how to
subscribe and continue milking people.
Yeah, you know, like, what is it? The rumors are Windows 10 is going to be the last Windows, and everything else is going to be subscription based from there on. You know, it sort of grinds my gears a bit. Everything's like, how much can we get money, a little bit of money out of you for a longer time?
That's why we're still using, Office 2010? Because I've still got the disk for that and I've got the codes for that. Mm. I'm not paying $9.99 a month or whatever it is to have access to it for the two PCs. Yeah. So, I don't know, but maybe that's because we're all old.
Yeah.
But I think we'll see where it takes us with that one.
With 8th edition, so one of the big changes is around the setting for 8th edition as well.
Yeah, we've had the game, the story move.
Yeah, so, you know, I guess the galaxy's been split in half and, you know, how
we've seen the return of the Primarchs and,
Yeah.
the Eldari have been now got a fourth faction, and we're about to see the Orc releases, which will be really exciting. The Space Wolves are almost dead. I forgot to tell you.
Good. I'm interested to see what they do with some of the other races, because they've really pulled out the stops, bringing out a Primarch.
We've had three so far now.
Wow. Real Primarchs.
You're right. Well, when Fulgrim comes out, we'll get our first real Primarch.
Actually, my three favourite Primarchs are already out in the 40K universe.
Yeah, I know.
You know.
Jerk.
I'm sure Fulgrim will make an appearance soon.
He's in the book. Yeah. It actually references it in the 8th edition book that Fulgrim basically goes, "What do you mean Gilliman's alive?" and leaves the Eye of Terror to make sure he kills Gilliman before Mortarion does.
Yeah, and look, I think that's the exciting part is, even though I'm not engaged playing the game at the moment, I haven't played it, I've kept up with the lore because I'm really interested in seeing what they're doing, and that's what's keeping me going on 40K at the moment, is seeing what Gilliman does, seeing whether, you know, he puts a bullet through them, head. You know, it's something you and I talk a lot about, is where they're heading with it, you know, with a Vulcan. You know, whether he does turn back up and doesn't go, "Oh my god, this place is buggered."
You know, or any of the loyal Primarchs for that matter.
If they're pulling Primarchs out for the Imperium, what sort of, you know, things are gonna happen with the Orcs? What's gonna happen with the Tau, you know? You look back in the lore, you know, the Emperor fought this, or Horus actually stepped in.
And kills the warlord of Ulrak or whatever it was called.
If this, you know, warlord was given a Primarch run for his money,
yeah,
you know, what are they going to bring out of the Warhammer lore?
Oh, look, I can't wait to see if they're going to do a new Ghazgul model. A big plastic Ghazgul would be amazing.
Yeah, it's like the savior of all kind. Exactly. I'd really like to see that guy.
There's plenty they can go down the road with those rules and stuff.
Certainly. So that it's exciting. It's an exciting time for Warhammer. Yeah, definitely. The Warhammer lore. And I'm really happy where they've taken it. Even though I haven't played the game, I've seen the lore and what they've done with the lore and the fluff, and I'm absolutely loving it.
So in terms of where we are now, in Days of Future Past, we have seen the rise and fall of different editions, and we've seen some very successful and some less so, and we've seen the company change its tact on many occasions.
And it's not.
And we're kind of back to where we started.
And we managed to do this really succinctly, and we fit it all into our 50-minute episode. Yeah,
I don't know how I'm going to cut this quite yet, but we're definitely into hour two and a bit now. So
yeah. This is a part of a conversation that Mike and I have.
Fairly regularly,
and we do. So we're just making you guys a part of it. This is not part of our conversation we normally have, bringing you guys into how we see things.
Yeah, so, you know, the game has evolved and changed, and it's...
And it feels like in the last 2 hours, so have I.
But, you know, it's a game that has kept us, Tim and I at the very least, engaged for, you know, 2+ decades now, and it's something that if you understand a bit where the game has come from, it can kind of give you some perspective on where the game might be going and why it might be the way it is now. So if you haven't ever seen any of those editions and you want to go and try and find them, the internet is a wonderful place. You can find lots of things online these days, and I'm not going to suggest what you may or may not do online, but if you want to go and check out some of the old editions, I'm sure you can find relevant topics and websites that might be able to help you with that.
Sure, everyone knows how to Google.
And well, I'm just trying to avoid any sort of copyright issues. So... you know, go and check them out. And if you're feeling absolutely gutsy, see if you can play a game with them. If you haven't played second edition,
you could pick it up cheaply off eBay.
Probably.
You know, you could pick up Rogue Trader. I mean,
Trader is not cheap, sadly.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it just having a few drinks and just trying something different.
Look, it's and all of the games, all of the editions of Warhammer have their own little quirks and benefits, and maybe, you know, getting some perspective on where we've come from is a good thing.
Yeah.
And hopefully you've learned something from the rambling.
And the cycles of game as well. It's definitely okay to take time off. It's okay to get back into it and take time off again. It's all part of the long-term cycle of the game.
Yeah, definitely. But look, we're going to wrap this up now, and we'll be back very quickly to say a fond farewell to our guest. And hopefully we'll see him again in another episode soon. So we'll be back in just a second. I'm not exactly sure, as I said just now, how I'm going to cut this episode up, because I reckon I've got nearly 3 hours of audio content to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm suspecting this might be a bonus double episode.
It might be a bonus triple episode.
It could very well be. So we have to say thank you to my good friend Tim, our good friend Tim, I should say.
Thank you very much for having me
for coming and chatting all things old Hammer and new Hammer and past and present and hopefully future. I look forward to playing a game of 8th edition with you and trying to teach you some of the finer points of...
I think it's a better idea to break out Rogue Trader and video that and get that up on the channel.
Look, I think we'd have to play a very small game of Rogue Trader because I think we'd be exceptionally rusty.
Oh, yeah, you're not playing for 6 hours.
I'd have to go back and learn the rules, probably.
I think we'd both be doing that, mate. It's
That's okay. Michael never knows the rules before he goes on to one of the battle reports. There's however many where he's gone, this is the first game I've played in 8th edition with Sisters of Battle. So
that's because I've been digging out all of my old armies, just one after another.
Yeah.
So I might actually have to start playing the same army with some consistency. So,
although then he'd have no excuse for losing.
Well, that is true. Yeah. But yeah, look, it's been a really wonderful wander down memory lane, and I know we've diverged many, many times over the last couple of hours. And
hopefully you've enjoyed this chat as much as we have.
Yeah, I've quite enjoyed it. I'm out of coffee, and it's past midnight. So we are going to wrap it up here. So thank you very much if you have persevered and listened to us for our 2+ hours of these episode or this episode or however I go ahead and cut it. Nice. That's future Mike's problem.
It's good painting background noise.
Yeah, definitely.
At the very least. You could have got at least 3 miniatures done by now.
And look, if you've played any of the older editions and you've got some thoughts on it, you're more than welcome to drop a comment below on the website or on the Facebook page when this podcast goes live. If you want to ask any questions about some of the weird stuff that we've talked about where Tim's dropped vortex grenades from a flying surfboard, you're more than welcome to post a question up to us and we'll make sure he gets it.
Still makes me chuckle after all these.
I still cringe and chuckle in equal measure about that. You know, if you want to ask any questions about some of the older editions, we'll dredge our brains and see what we can remember. And
and if we've messed up too, if we've misquoted I'm
assuming
wrong,
that's the case.
Feel free to correct us because...
Oh, no, don't. You keep that to yourself.
the memory's not perfect and, you know, Mike brought up quite a few points that I completely forgot about, you know, the old days. So
no, look, I think that if there's nothing else to take away from this, enjoy the games you're playing now with your mates. Enjoy them for what they are. Don't take them too seriously. And hopefully in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, even if you're not playing the game anymore, when you do see those mates, you're going to have these sorts of stories and that sort of, that little laugh where you go, hey, what edition are we on now, man? Remember, oh, we're on the 11th edition. You want to crack that out and show me how this works? And it'll be just like falling off a bike.
I think there's a saying that I try and remember, you know, in 5 years' time, will this problem still be a problem? And so when you're playing games and there's an issue over how a rule should be interpreted or how one person sees the mechanics of the game versus someone else, in 5 years' time, is that actually going to matter? But in 5 years' time, are you going to remember hanging out with your friends on a Friday night at Crags or hanging out with friends at Tuesday night at Outpost or, you know, in your mum's garage or basement drinking Mountain Dew? You know,
we don't have
what
basements
are you...
in Australia, thankfully.
No, we don't. but we do have a lot of garages and patios where a lot of games happen. But, you know, what are you going to remember in 5 years' time?
Yeah.
And just that's the point of the game. It's supposed to be fun.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't remember any of the fights.
Well, you do, but good-naturedly, I'm sure.
I remember that Haywire incident.
Oh, yeah. That was still my favourite kill in the whole game.
Or the virus bomb, remember that?
Yeah, I remember that. But see, both times I've been part of that as the antagonist, as the protagonist, not the antagonist.
Yeah, but Owen was yelling a lot.
Yeah. maybe not. Didn't have such a good day a couple of those times.
That's exactly
what
we're
talking
about.
Funnily enough, he doesn't play anymore, does he?
No, and he moved on the other side of the country. Yeah. What does that say?
That's exactly what I was saying. Mike and I are doing the whole, remember that time when?
Yeah.
Remember that time? And that's the precious thing. You know, 20, 30 years on, that's the precious thing that I carry with me.
Yeah, the wins and losses don't matter.
No. Yeah, because in 20 years' time, no one's going to remember a Facebook conversation, but you might remember hanging out on a Friday night with your friends.
Yeah, definitely. So on that little... I don't know, slightly sappy note, I guess.
I'm always sappy. You can count on me.
I know we can. I absolutely know we can. We're going to leave it there, guys. We hope you've enjoyed the chat. Like, share, subscribe, all that other stuff. And we will see you for the next episode. Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Michael.
We'll catch you guys for the next episode. Bye.
Where are you going now? Back to the future?
Nope. Already in there.
You've been listening to the Objective Secured podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, you can visit our website, objectivesecured.com.au. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/objectivesecured, or you can email us, obsec@optusnet.com.au. Thanks for listening.